Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. So, a little bit of news. I have a new podcast project which is up and running. The first episode is up on a website called lukeburridge.com. You've probably heard me mention that before. /creative. The podcast is called Luke's Creative Podcast. It's not a very interesting name, but it's a podcast where I talk to interesting people about interesting things, about creativity and stuff like that. I've actually only just put the first episode up so far, and I'm waiting for iTunes to confirm or what do I have to do? Do something with the RSS feed to make sure that it's actually appearing in iTunes, and I can put a little button on it saying subscribe via iTunes on my website. And once that's ready to go, I'll start putting up other episodes, and I'll include the first main interview episode of that here in this podcast feed as well, just to remind you what's going on. So just warning for your future about that coming up. Not really much other news, sort of working on other projects, new juggling show in the works, and I'm kind of, what else am I doing? Pretty much, just hanging out in Berlin. I've taken 2 months off work, and it's been awesome. Bit of a crazy time in my life at the moment, but a lot of good fun. Don't need to go into any details here, though. So I'm just going to get straight on to today's book. It's called I Am Legend by Richard Matheson. And it's from, let me just bring up the Goodreads.com page here. It's very easy to find. So first published in 1954, 317 pages. And Audible.com says it's 5 hours and 19 minutes, narrated by Robertson Dean. And I decided to read this because it keeps coming up in different conversations that I had. We were talking about this, when I'm talking about chatting with Jesse from and Scott from SFF Audio. It seems to come up on most podcasts that we do. And a number of listeners have asked me, have I read it or they want a review? And I have actually read the book before years ago, and I always, I remember really enjoying it. More recently, of course, I've seen the film with Will Smith, based on this book, or based on the sort of like the premise of this book. And lots of other people say, oh, it doesn't really follow the book, it's not a very good movie, or whatever like that. I actually don't mind it as a movie, I thought it was pretty good. I've not seen the other movie versions, but it was okay, entertaining enough. I know it doesn't have the same ending as as the book does, or the other movies do, but I still think as it is, it's a pretty good, pretty decent movie. It's got a good atmosphere, even though it was obviously edited for story-wise and other things, so it doesn't clearly make sense all the way through. So it came up yet again when I was chatting with Jesse the other day, or a few weeks ago, and I decided I'll just get the Audible version, and I'm really glad I did. So here's a little bit of blurb that it says on the back of the book, just a little bit of summary. It goes, in I Am Legend, a plague has decimated the world, and those unfortunate enough to survive are transformed into bloodthirsty creatures of the night. Robert Neville is the last living man on Earth. Every other man, woman and child has become a vampire, and they are all hungry for Neville's blood. By day, he is a hunter, stalking the sleeping undead through the abandoned ruins of civilization. By night, he barricades himself in his home and prays for the dawn. How long can one man survive in a world of vampires? So yeah, pretty much sets it up. The book. So I'll just get into the review. The world is set in Los Angeles, not as the movie. Actually, I'm not going to mention the movie too much, but for some reason, I always, when thinking back at this book, the movie sort of coloured different things about it. So I actually really like the New York setting, even though I think LA is a better setting. So he's out in LA suburbia or something like that. Anyway, he's got his house, and this. It's written in 1954. I think it was set a little bit in the future from 1954. And the world itself is actually, it really holds up well. There's very, very few times when you read this book and go, oh yeah, this was written in 1954. Most of the time you're reading this book, because it's set after civilization and, the technology is just down to whatever one man can use by himself. And, he goes to the library and stuff. Of course, there's nothing about, there's nothing about, computers, of course not. And there's nothing about anything. There's nothing about politics. There's nothing about war, or maybe tiny little bits of there in the flashback sections. But it's like a very, very neutral time setting, and it holds up really well. There, like I say, there's no point when I was thinking this is dated in any way, except for like one or two very small and very forgivable parts of the book. And then the setting within that world is it's one house, because Robert Neville, he's you know, he's the last man on Earth. You know, he's, and so he has to save himself from the vampires. So he stays in one house, and every morning he patches up the house, which the vampires have done some damage to him. And he talks about that quite a lot. And then he can only travel in one day as far as he can drive in one day, and then drive back home again, because he doesn't know if he's ever going to, you know, be able to get somewhere which is also as safe as the place where he lives, because, you know, at night he is at a great disadvantage to the vampires, whereas in the daytime the vampires can't survive at all, of course not. So, which really sets up the plot. Everything happens in this one place, and Robert Neville, like I say, he's the last known, he's the only known survivor that he knows of, and he's managed to survive this plague that comes across the world and kills most people, but some people, like you say, do survive, but they only survive in the form of vampires, and the disease spreads, everyone is infected, and so yeah, like I say, by day he wakes up in the morning, and oh no, like at night. Well, put it this way. He protects his home by boarding up all the windows because they throw stuff at him. But he puts garlic all the way around his house, and mirrors and crosses and all these other things which are meant to deflect vampires. Of course, at the beginning of the book, he's not quite sure actually what works against vampires and what doesn't. He's just going based on the legends and the myths about vampires, and he's not so much about the science of vampires. So he puts loads of stuff around his house, running water, all these different things that scare vampires away. And he's not really quite sure what's working. But they don't actually come up to his house, you know, because of the garlic and the running water and the mirrors that he puts around. But they throw stones at him and taunt him from out in the street in front of him, in front of his place. And so then every morning he wakes up, he patches his house up, and then in the afternoon he, you know, makes sure he's got enough to eat. He goes scavenging, but also he goes vampire hunting. So he goes into a house and he looks around the house and he finds all the vampires. They're sort of they hide like under beds and things where it's really dark and, you know, there's no sunlight gets to them or anything like that. And during the day they're very lethargic, they can't move very much, they're very they're all just hiding and things like that. So then he gets them out, drives stakes through the hearts, and that's what he does a lot of, actually. He spends a lot of time making stakes because he gets through a lot of Dowling. So he puts the stakes through the heart and they all, you know, die. And then he goes back home, and then his day begins again. And that's pretty much the first third of the book, as he, you know, he struggles to keep them away from his house, and he's also really struggling with sort of like depression and apathy, because he's not quite sure why he's going on with it, and he does these stupid things, and he starts drinking, and he smokes, and he drinks, and he smokes, and he's constantly getting drunk. And then every night he somehow managed to get inside, and he's saying, oh, they're too loud, I've got to soundproof the house because they're always throwing stones and they're really loud outside. And there's a lot of stuff with him, because the women, the vampires outside want his blood, and they know he's in there, and they know he's still a real human, and all these sort of mad vampires are driving him mad and trying to get him to go out the house, and all the women vampires parade outside naked, and of course, like, he's the only man left alive, and he knows that he's never gonna have sex again. So they're going, you know, and he's fighting against his urges, and he's always going, oh, the women, oh, like this. Very, very interesting. So the first third of the book is sort of him, you know, his normal routine. And then we get a flashback to before the plague, where his, you know, his wife and his daughter are succumbing to the illness, and we get a bit of backstory there as well. And then the second third of the book is the kind of like science fiction-y part, where he's trying to work out what causes people to turn into vampires. I mean, these aren't equal thirds, but this is sort of like the next section of the book. Like I say, this science fiction at least could be straight horror, but and maybe people do just consider this to be a horror book, but it's got the cool post-apocalyptic stuff, and that's really well realized, and it's all medical science that he's trying to work out, you know, why people turn into vampires and what the plague was and stuff like that. And it's very, he goes about it in a scientific way, a very science fiction-y kind of way, to get into sort of like, yes, this is definitely in the science fiction vein of vampires, let me put it that way. What else, another note here, oh yeah, so then we get another flashback, and this time we get to the point where Robert Neville is trying to, you know, deal with his wife has died, and he tries to bury his wife, but burying people is very illegal, everyone has to be cremated, but he said, I'm not going to cremate my wife, I'm going to bury her. But because she's undead, she doesn't stay buried very well. It's very, very creepy part of the book. And then the last third of the book, it's set later on, you know, it's, you know, of course it's set later on, but we're back to the main timeline again, And he gets a visitor. Turns out he's not the only human left at all. And I'm going to stop there with my recap of the plot because I don't want to spoil anything. I've really not spoiled anything so far because it's, you know, stuff set up. But we get into this bit of a mystery kind of plot. And like you say, most of the book is pretty basic. You know, he's just making ends meet. And, you know, all of the drama and all of the conflict is internal. It's in his brain. It's him against himself. But then we get this great, really interesting twist at the end, which is fantastically foreshadowed throughout. Like, everything that takes place in this book. It's a very short book, and there's lots and lots crammed into it, but there's hardly, like, a paragraph goes by which isn't a clue to something which is coming later, which he's going to discover about the vampires. You know, first of all, he's just going, oh, yeah, you know, he notices everything he needs, and we as the reader could notice everything he needs. And Robert Neville, he asks all the right questions, and we as readers should be asking the same kind of questions. And at the end, you know, the answers are provided admirably, and Robert Neville, our character in the book, he accepts the answers admirably as well. But I think, as I've read this book before, I wasn't really worried about knowing what the end is, but I did pick up like a new appreciation of just how much is squeezed into like a novel, a short novel. At one point you're thinking, well, not a lot's happening, but then as more stuff happens you go, oh, a lot was happening, we just needed to be reminded about how important it was a little bit later. Pretty good plot. No, very good plot. Exactly the plot that it needs to be. If the book was longer, it wouldn't be a very good plot. And if it was shorter, it wouldn't be a very good plot. But it's perfectly, perfectly pitched here. The characters in the book, very interesting. There's only like 4 or 5 characters in total. And Robert Neville, of course, is our main character. I keep calling him by his full name because the narrator of the book, which is him, he is sort of like the viewpoint character in much of it, even though I think it is a third-person narrative, but it's very close to what he's seeing. But it always refers to Robert Neville as Robert Neville, and it's like the character of Robert Neville always referring to himself as Robert Neville so he doesn't forget his full name because he's the only person he ever talks to. And he does talk to himself a little bit, but, you know, there's nobody else to call him his own name. This book is really about that, you know, about keeping your identity, keeping purpose in life. It's all about loneliness and like how mad you would be or how mad you would go if you were like I said before, you know that you're never going to have another conversation. You know that you're never going to, you know, have sex again, and you have to find meaning in all of that. And that's what this makes this book so interesting, so fascinating, is at the beginning. I mean, the character of Robert Neville, he goes on such a journey. At the beginning, he's like, oh, drunkard and stuff like that. And later on, he's still a drunkard, but, you know, he's a drunkard with a purpose. And then he's a drunkard who loses purpose, and then he gains his purpose and loses his purpose. And that's what this book is about. And I think it's a fascinating study into the mind of Robert Neville. Even though he doesn't, like, on the surface, you just go, oh, he's just a drunk guy trying to make his way in the world. He doesn't seem that complex. Actually, it's very deep. The journey that he goes on is very, very deep and very, very satisfying. There's another character who we know by their full name, and that is Ben Courtman. And Ben Courtman also calls Robert Neville by his full... Oh, no, does it? No, he just calls him Neville. But Robert Neville always thinks of Ben Courtman as Ben Courtman. Ben Courtman was Robert Neville's friend or colleague or someone he knew anyway. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was someone he knew before the plague, before... And Ben Courtman is now a vampire, and he's a vampire in the neighborhood, and he keeps coming around, and he's one of the main crazy vampires who comes at night and shouts at Robert Neville, but can't get close because of all the garlic and the mirrors and the running water and the crosses and crucifixes or whatever they are. But Ben Courtman continuously goads Neville from outside, and no matter how times Robert Neville shoots Ben Courtman, he keeps coming because that's the way that vampires are. They don't get damaged by gunshots and things like that. They need stakes to the heart and things. But because they used to be friends, you can see that Neville probably could go out, not just shooting him, but probably could, like, have Ben Courtman in his power. And he's always saying, oh, Ben Courtman's driving me mad. He's driving me mad. I'm going to kill him. He's going to be the last vampire or the next vampire to kill. And he goes out searching for them. But you realize actually by the end of the book that Robert Neville doesn't actually want to kill Ben Courtman at all. It could be because they used to be friends, or it could be that Ben Courtman is now the face of the enemy, and he needs the face of the enemy there to keep going. Because that's actually what is Courtman, that's the function he serves for Robert Neville, but also that's the function he serves within the book as well. Because if it was just a different horde of vampires coming, you know, over to torment Robert Neville at night, and then in the daytime, Robert goes out and kills them, so there's constantly replenishing source of vampires outside, they would, like you say, they'd be just a mass. They'd have no face. But you need a face for a villain. And Ben Courtman, that's this function that he serves. He becomes the tormentor, the lead tormentor among other tormentors. And I do think this is important, which is strange, because it brought back to mind the Lord of the Rings movie in the first one. It's a bit strange, because in the first movie, there's not really anyone who is, like, evil. Well, there is, you know, I guess there's Sauron, who's just this big eye, and it's really difficult. It's really difficult to make, you know, a big eye a person. And then in the end battle, they have all this, you know, they're just battling orcs. And of course, in the book, the orcs are just this big pile of orcs, and they're just like, orcs, and everyone shoots them and stuff. But in the movie, they actually created, like, the lead orc guy who, you know, is leading the orcs into... No, it's not the orcs, it's the Uruk-hai or something, the ones that can come out in the daytime, or whatever it is. I don't know. So I remember seeing in the movie, and actually a bit of the making of, or was it, maybe I watched it with a commentary track on or something in the first movie. They said, yeah, we had to create this character to have a face of the enemy in the first movie, because otherwise we don't have that kind of personality. And that's what Ben Courtman serves in this book as well. And other characters, yeah, we get a bit of his, of Robert Neville's wife, and pre-infection Courtman as well, in the flashbacks as well. Not so much time with them. And then, of course, you've got this other character who, if I talk about here, I'll spoil the end of the book. And, of course, that's when the book kicks into high gear, because all of the things that Robert Neville has learnt, that suddenly, you know, the narrator doesn't get into his head so much at the end of the book, mainly, I think, because he isn't drinking so much and he's not ranting so much to himself. So there's lots of stuff going on, and when this other character turns up, that's when we really find the true character of Robert Neville and see what he's gone through and how much he's changed. And there's a bit of stuff that goes on between the two characters, which I'm a bit like, really? But whatever, I'll let it go. It's suitable. How am I meant to know what people in that situation are really meant to be like? Moving on to the science stuff in the book, because I guess it's science fiction. So not non-vampire stuff first. I guess there's it's the normal post-apocalyptic stuff. I've mentioned this quite a few times in different books that I've reviewed here on the podcast. You know, it's like trying to recreate technology with only the knowledge that you gain from the books that you find in the library. We had this quite a bit in Earth Abides, and, you know, in these what was the one that I read the other day? What was it called? Let me see if I can find this list here. Oh yeah, Alas Babylon, and yeah, there's quite a few of these post-apocalyptic books that I've talked about, and it's always a similar kind of thing. It's like, okay, suddenly if you don't have electricity anymore, what do you do? And it's a great, like, thought experiment for yourself as well. You think, well, how much, you know, how useless would I be in such a situation? I'm thinking I'm pretty useless, you know. I'm really good with wood. I could keep my house like Robert Neville does, and the electricity stuff that he does, I could probably, you know, fix the light bulbs and do the things that he does there. But, you know, he uses a car and he drives around in a car, and I'm thinking, well, I would break cars and then just have to pick up a new one and use that one. There's no way I could keep engines running and things like that. I'm pretty dyslexic when it comes to cars. And then, of course, you get into, like, the scientific stuff, the medical experiments that Robert Neville does, and I just don't think I would be able to do that. Robert Neville somehow manages to do it. He makes a lot of mistakes along the way, and it takes him years to do it. But then again, he does have almost infinite free time. But then again, I also almost have, like, infinite free time, because I'm self-employed and don't work very much. But I spend most of my days juggling and playing music and messing about online. Without the internet, I wouldn't be able to do what I would need to do to survive without the internet. I think that was a great quote, actually. Someone said, you know, the internet has created a generation of people who couldn't create the internet. I really love that quote. Not sure if it's true or not, but I think it's quite telling. And then, of course, you've got the science of the vampires as well. Lots of bacteria and biology and epidemiology and stuff like that. But I don't want to go into it too much here, because that's what the book is about. You know, the... the view of vampires in this book is scientific. Well, it's not so much scientific, but like I say, science fiction-y kind of view. And I really enjoy Matheson's take on them. But then again, that's the point of writing a vampire story. If you're going to write a vampire story and it just is just that you go, okay, what are the rules of vampirism? These are the rules. Okay, now I'm going to write a book about vampires. It's not going to become a classic. There's no reason why anybody wants to read just another book about vampires. The things that make vampire stories, and I guess the same thing with zombies and these other monsters, is your twist on it, your take on the rules. You're introducing a new rule. I'm sure Bram Stoker's Dracula didn't have all the rules that we know today, and I'm sure, you know, some people take out rules and other people put in new rules and things, and there's different ways to do it. Like once I saw this this vampire movie, and someone had a full body blood transfusion, and they were cured of the vampirism, and I'm like, okay, well, sure. I mean, it was a shit film. I can't even remember what it was called now. But that's what they did, and I'm like, okay, that's a cool rule. And in here, there are some rules, and there's some rules explained away, and there's some rules that, you know, are psychological, and there's some rules that are physiological, and there's some rules which are spiritual, and all these different ways that you can approach what rule set you're using. Are they going to be sparkly vampires? Can they wear, you know, what's it in, like, in Blade, the guy puts on, what is he, half vampire Blade, so he's called the Daywalker, and he can go out in the sun, but someone else puts on, like, really thick sun cream and can also go out in the sun, another vampire, and you know, all these different takes on it, and I really enjoy the different takes that people have on vampires. What was the there was another, I've talked about this before, let me see if I can find the book. Which book was it? Oh, Blindsight, that was it. Blindsight by Peter Watts. That was a vampires in space one, and one of his ideas was that vampires, you know, sort of genetically they survive this long and stuff. And the only thing that I didn't like about that was the crucifix thing, where, you know, if they see right angles they get scared, and I'm like, oh, that's not that. I think that would be a little bit too limiting, but you know, he worked it back in there. And that's vampires in space with no self-awareness, or whatever the cute thing that he was going on there. I've lost my notes. What was I going to talk about now? I've lost my writing. Let's talk about writing. Very nicely written. Nothing really springs to mind right now, but there's some really marvelous turns of phrase in here. I wish I should have made some notes of them as I went down, but I can't flick back through the book and find any examples now because I listened to it as an audiobook, which I will talk about. The narration by Robertson Dean is, when I was listening to it, it started off and I'm like, oh, this is a bit like bombastic. It's a little bit too overblown. But then as it went on, I realized what he was doing and I was just like, holy shit, this is awesome narration. Because, you know, some people, they'll just read the text and you think, oh, that's good. And other people do different voices for different characters, and they put a little bit of different emphasis, and there's some of the most annoying narrations is when people talk like this and then talk like this and then talk, and then there's suddenly action and then action and then it's all like this, and it's like they just sort of pump up their voice to do the actiony bits, and then when they calm down they can calm down a bit like that. Now Robertson Dean does something completely different. He just takes, well, let me put it this way, the book is written so much from like one person's point of view, which is Robert Neville. Either he's doing something, or he's saying something, or he's thinking something, or something is being said to him, or something is being done to him, or whatever's going on like that. So, except for some very short passages, it's all taking place like within one person, and Dean takes this into a very dramatic performance. You know, all of the different things that he's saying, and he's talking about the drinking and talking about the women, like he's going, you know, because that's in the text as well, where he's sort of exclaiming about how much he wants the women and how much he's damning himself and how much he's, you know, cursing himself for wanting the women outside. And then there's Courtman outside and he's shouting, Neville! Neville! And it just becomes this fantastically, like, theatrical performance in a way. And it's just really, really, really good. So this book, definitely, it's one of my favourites, I guess. And since watching the movie, though, you know, I'd forgotten the big parts of the book, and then I watched this movie, and it sort of got mixed up in my brain what was in the movie and what was, you know, what was actually in the book as well. And then, Yeah, and then listening to it now, a real treat. So because this was a real sort of good nostalgia hit for me, because it's been so many years since I read it, and it completely wiped out the movie out of my mind. Well, not wiped the movie out of my mind, but cleared up all the misconceptions that I misremembered about the book. And because it's got a totally awesome rating, I'm going to give it a really high rating. Actually, someone just mentioned just before on goodreads.com, I'd given it five. I'd originally given it 4 stars from my previous reading, because I, like I say, I remember enjoying it so much. And then someone said, Luke gave a book 5. Oh, yeah, then I upped the stars on Goodreads to 5, you know, and said, Luke gave a book 4 stars. I'm putting this down on my calendar. I can't wait to hear the podcast. That's by Tom. That was like a few hours ago he said that. And yeah, so the reason I think it's 5 stars, I think, is only slightly too high, but on goodreads.com I can't give anything, you know, fractions or decimal places of stars like I can do now. So I'm not going to give it 5 stars because it's not a perfect book. Because I did find it chilling, but it didn't really have an effect on me in kind of an emotional or intellectual, like the other books that I've given 5 stars to, they've, you know, 2 of them have made me sort of cry, which is, you know, it doesn't happen very often when I'm reading a book. And there's other books which I rate really highly because they're they challenge me on an intellectual level. But this book, after reading it, I thoroughly enjoyed it. The narration was really, really good. It was a perfect length of the book, you know, just like 5 hours to get through. You know, I got through it in very short order. But I don't think it's going to change my view of what fiction is capable of, or what I want to do with my own writing, and I don't think it's going to have any deeper effect on my life, like, say, something like reading something like you know, Flowers for Algernon, which is a book I gave 5 stars to. That was one of those books where I think I went into quite a lot of detail about how much it made me cry. You know, I don't think very much will change after reading I Am Legend. But maybe, then again, if it was an unknown story and it was the first time I read it, and, you know, with this narration, and I didn't know the twist at the end and all the other things that could come up which might have spoiled my enjoyment slightly, I'd give it 5 stars. But I think 4.9 stars will have to do with this one. Anyway, what's on my note? Oh, I missed something. Normally I talk about the themes of the book. Actually, I didn't make any notes here. I think I've gone into quite a few of them already. Just read the book. There's not a lot for me to say, I guess, about the themes of it, which I've not said already. It's about loneliness and despair, and about self-worth, and it's about self-respect. And no, it's not so much about self-respect. It's more about taking responsibility for your actions. And that, and then at the same time, it's a book about relationships when there's nobody there. Like, it's about love. But then how long you can keep loving someone after they have changed in some ways. And I guess it's very much a book about perception. But like I say, it doesn't take too long to read, doesn't take too long to listen. Give it a read, give it a, you know, and yeah, no, give it a listen. Probably give it a listen, because I really enjoyed this narration. So 4.9 stars. I guess after 3.4 years, I've only given 3 books 5 stars. And there's now, let me have a look at the list here. And I've now given 3 books 4.9 stars as well. So it takes a lot to impress me. To get 5 stars, you've got to have me either in tears or, you know, fuck with my head in some way. It'll be really cool. That's about it. Oh no, let me have a quick look on goodreads.com, see what other people look at. I know lots and lots of people have read this book, so let's see what it says here. Yeah, 54 friends have rated it, and they've given it an 3.92 rating on average, my friends here, and 3.8 rating on average by goodreads.com users in total. Yeah, so Greg rated it 4 stars. The women. Who else puts some other people didn't rate it so highly. Joe Sweeney, 1 star. What the fuck? Chris rated it 3 stars. Alain rated it 2. Alain, you suck. Lots of people marked it to read as well. Anyway, not much to add there. So what's the next book that I'm going to do? I've got, I'm reading at the moment The Gardens of the Moon, or which is the Malazan Book of the Dead, book 1 by, Stephen Erickson, I think it is, someone like that. Stephen Erickson? I can't remember. And I also just bought The Judging Eye, which is the first book in the second trilogy by fantasy trilogy by R. Scott Bakker. He did the Prince of Nothing series, which I really enjoyed, and this is a continuation from that. And I've got some audiobooks as well. I've got When Gravity Fails by George Alec Effinger, which is a book that we chatted about once on the SFF audio podcast, which I'm looking forward to. And also on top of that, I feel like a little bit like an Alistair Reynolds hit again, so I might do Terminal World, which I've also got sitting on my iPod, which are sitting there for a rainy day. That's about it for this podcast. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. Get in touch. Send me your book recommendations. I really enjoy having conversations with people by email. I reply to every single email that I get. So please email me. You can follow me on Twitter, @LukeBurridge. And Twitter, what else? Yeah, on goodreads.com. So I can see what you think of the books that you're reading, and I can also see what you think of the books that I'm reading, which is more important, because I want to see what your recommendations and things like that. And what's the other thing? Oh yeah, check out my blog, lukeburridge.com/blog. I'm putting up new videos and music and photography all the time, and my new podcast, so check out that. It's called Luke's Creative Podcast. There's only one episode so far, which is just an introduction episode where I'm talking about what the podcast is about, but check that out, and then catch the new episodes of that when they come out too. You can find that at lukeburridge.com/creative. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.